Welcome to the College Commons Podcast, passionate perspectives from Judaism's leading thinkers, brought to you by HUC Connect, the Hebrew Union College's online platform for continuing education. I'm Joshua Holo, your host. Welcome to the College Commons Podcast and our special series on the 150th anniversary of the Hebrew Union College. We're going to speak with Dr. David Mendelson, who is Senior Lecturer of Israel Studies and Modern Jewish History Emeritus on the Toby Family Campus of the Hebrew Union College in Jerusalem. Both educator and historian of education, he wrote The History of Jewish Education in England between 1944 and 1988. He is the past director of HUC's Year in Israel program, and he has been a scholar in residence at the University of Southern California, Brandeis University, and Michigan State University. And he is a frequent lecturer across the United States. Dr. David Mendelson, David, my friend, welcome back to the College Commons Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
As we celebrate 150 years of the Hebrew Union College, we often note the college's role in shaping American Judaism by virtue of ordaining American rabbis. But since 1970, we have required that our students launch their rabbinical education with their first year of study in Israel. What does that requirement say about what it meant to be an American rabbi in 1970, and what does it say today?
Well, the decision that was taken by the Board of Governors in October of 1969, very much at the behest of the president of the day, Nelson Glick, along with the very important support of the Central Conference of American Rabbis, the CCAR, I think it said something very specific about a time and a context. The time was clearly a post-Six-Day War, but it's also, of course, a lot to do with the American context, where ethnicity, in particular in America, was becoming something that was much more legitimate and public. So I think that the decision that was taken reflected, it seems to me, a broadening or maybe a deepening of a Jewish relationship and identity with Israel, in part, by the way, because I think there was a sense of crisis at this time amongst the Reform Movement, by not only the Reform Movement, about Judaism and Jewish life in America. And it seems that ethnicity was a way of engaging people in a way that actually, in the public realm at least, was not so popular. So I think that certainly reflected a very broad consensus, because if you think about this, Zionism wasn't always a consensus. I mean, after all, back in the day, if you go back to the days of the Pittsburgh Platform at the end of the 19th century, it's very clear the Reform was anti-Zionist, and it took a while before the movement became more sympathetic.
You yourself pointed out that Nelson Glick himself had not been a Zionist until he became president of HUC.
Yes, I think it's fair to say that after the establishment of the state, but particularly in the 1950s, he became much warmer to political Zionism. He'd been very sympathetic to visiting the land of Israel and, of course, his archaeological work, which was really a prime concern of his, and establishing the college in Jerusalem in 1963 was very much part of that. But he wasn't a political Zionist. He became that in the aftermath, I would say, of the establishment of the state and particularly making his connections with all sorts of important Israeli political figures of the day, Levi Eshkol, Golda Meir, and so on. So I think it's fair to say that the decision that was taken back in 1969 was a result of events both here in Israel with the Six-Day War and so on, but also the result of events in the United States of America, which I think sometimes tend to get forgotten. The focus tends to be on, oh, well, it's the Six-Day War, 1967. Actually, Nelson Glick came to this decision, meaning in his mind and in his desire, before the Six-Day War, which is important to say. It is true that the Central Conference of American Rabbis really were ignited by the Six-Day War in terms of, therefore, the commitment to Israel. And you can see that with all of their proceedings. The fact that the first conference of the CCR outside, if I'm not mistaken, the United States of America, in Jerusalem was in 1970 is also telling.
I'm curious to hear your thoughts about how it's changed to feel the need to educate our rabbis in Israel both the motivation, such as you've described as related to 1970, but also maybe the consequences and the effects?
Well, the consequences of the decision back in 1969, and of course the first year in 1970, I think has been dramatic for the reform movement in terms of its engagement with Israel. There's no doubt that those years, I'm now thinking well beyond 1970s, 80s, 90s, but really did bring the reform movement with a very significant engagement with Israel. And of course, the language of the centrality of Israel was pertinent too to the reform movement. It joined, after all, the World Zionist Organization has been very active in it. And this is a lot to do with people who graduated the Year in Israel program through the reform movement. But I think it's fair to say that there has been some disappointment with Israel that may be soft. And I think certainly we get the impression there's a younger generation in America that's more even alienated from Israel. And that's something that, again, I want to suggest has two parts to it. One is, I think, partly connected to some of the policies of the government of the State of Israel. I don't want to be too simplistic about this, but it's certainly in the last 40 years, we've seen the country move in a more religious direction, and I mean by that an Orthodox direction, a particularly religious Zionist direction, with, of course, a commitment on their part to settlement in the West Bank, albeit there were times when the labor movement was also sympathetic to settlement in the West Bank.
Right.
But it's perhaps important to say that that atmosphere, and by the way, the success of religious Zionists to take and gain major positions of responsibility in the government, particularly in the last number of years,
indeed,
as well as, I would say, the influence of the Haredi world in Israel and this phenomenon we have now of a populist party now, the Likud, I think that has certainly affected a good number of our students. But I think what goes with that, and in some ways maybe even more important, is the influence of what we might call the whole progressive world, wokeism, and how that has, I think, engaged students who are obviously graduates of universities in America, where these ideas have certainly become pertinent and relevant, and have changed the sort of understanding about Israel. I mean, there are all the slogans I'm sure we're all familiar with, whether it's calling the Jews not indigenous to the land of Israel, we're part of a white settler European movement. All of that, I think, has had an influence. And it seems to me that some of our students are less enthusiastic, maybe, of coming to Israel. Not all of them, but I think some. I think what's critical for me about all this is that I've always said that the Year in Israel is an opportunity for our students to appreciate what I've called the responsibilities and privileges of statehood, of power, of political power. And I still hold that to be a very critical experience. In other words, you don't have to come out joining AIPAC at the end of the day, but you certainly have to come out of the Year in Israel, and as a result of being here in Israel, engaging with the dilemmas that emerge from sovereignty, which, of course, is a unique experience. I mean, over the last 1800, 1900 years, we didn't have that. And it seems as though we're not quite as well-trained, maybe, in dealing with some of these responsibilities. Granted, we're in a very difficult neighborhood. I think that's true. So that my sense is that the importance of coming to Israel is certainly about that. But it's also, of course, all the things that come with it, which is living by the Hebrew calendar, which I think for our students is really interesting and fascinating, because after all, Jewish life outside of Israel is mainly focused on family, or it's in community organizations and the synagogue. Here in Israel, of course, there's a much broader experience, and the rhythm of our lives is dictated by a Hebrew calendar. And I think for many of our students, that's one of the things they really enjoy and take away with them, that they feel, wow, that's a different experience. So that for me is still very, very meaningful, and therefore, of course, relevant as the Year in Israel program continues.
I had the privilege of seeing some of the documents that you relied on for your article about the beginning of the requirement in 1970 for our rabbinical students to study in Israel. And one of those documents you pointed out to me was a list of the students and the early students who requested special dispensation to go to Israel, some of whom are my friends and colleagues today. The list struck me through the lens of today by virtue of its monogender. They're all men, even though we had already accepted our first woman into the rabbinical school at HUC. So I'd like to ask you your sense of the year in Israel as a gendered experience, both then, 1970, and now, and how it's changed.
Well, I think this is dramatic. The fact that there were, what, six students who came to Jerusalem in the first year, all men, as you correctly point out, and it's fair to say that all of them very young. I mean, these were people who literally, almost overwhelmingly, had been undergraduates. They came to Israel, and this was the scene. In that sense, really dramatic. That, of course, has changed, because if you look at the makeup of students who are at the college, obviously in their first year, but even afterwards, it's very clear that the gender balance has changed dramatically. If I'm not mistaken, during the course of my 8 years as the director of the program, and even 21 years, I'm fairly confident in saying, since I was involved, there was a majority, I think, of women in the program.
Yeah.
So that's, of course, a very different story. And I think with that, there are all sorts of questions, again, which are not only about the men and the women. We've also, of course, had students who are trans students, the whole experience, students who are gay. Of course, there were such students back in 1970. There's a very good chance they weren't open about their sexuality, if you will. So I think in that sense, it's really a very different story, which, of course, reflects the broader world where the students come from. And the rabbinate today is clearly not a male area.
Do we still see non-male identifying students in Jerusalem today in the Year in Israel program confronting distinct challenges in Jerusalem at large, for example?
There's no question that the makeup, the demography of the city of Jerusalem is clearly very conservative. And that, by the way, includes the Arab population in East Jerusalem, but it certainly, you know, it resonates with the Haredi population, which I think is about 30% of Jerusalem's population, which makes the Reform movement very interesting, curious, but also very small minority. And students have faced, in particular, you know, difficulties, you know, walking the streets of Jerusalem as a woman wearing a kippah. Eyebrows have been raised, but it's gone beyond that. And there are students who faced very unpleasant experiences of that nature, which is true of students who are outwardly gay. We had an incident 1 year during my time where there was a student at a pizza house. There was a guy who refused to serve him because he was gay and wearing a gay kippah. Those experiences certainly are things that have affected the year in Israel.
To the degree you can encapsulate an item or a phenomenon or an experience, what would you impressionistically describe as the most enduringly meaningful part of the year in Israel for our students? Or perhaps how has such a significant part of the experience changed over the years?
That's a very difficult question. And I think it's particularly difficult because it seems to me that our students are obviously individuals and what impacts them is very difficult to determine. I mean, I suppose that's the beauty and challenge of education. How do we know when a student is being impacted in such a dramatic way? If we knew the answer to that question, then I suppose we'd be in a much better position.
Well said, well said.
But I think to answer your question, the major goal of the Year in Israel program, I think, was the question of Hebrew. And because of, I mean, I think it's fair to say the limited success of some of the programs that were designed before, namely the Tawanda program, because it was based in Tawanda at this retreat and then moved to Cincinnati, there wasn't success. And students actually found it all traumatic. And when they came to look at texts in the Hebrew language, they had real difficulties. So there's no doubt that one of the things for our students, which I think has been very meaningful and I think rather successful, is the engagement with the Hebrew language in an environment which is a Hebrew-speaking environment, albeit our students don't always take advantage of the Hebrew environment, but has made it more comfortable for them, I think, to interact with sacred texts and even to become a little bit more familiar with the language as a spoken language. So I think that is definitely part of the story. There's always a challenge here because my own perspective, and given that I teach Israel studies, I think it's fair to say that one of the things that we've been good at the college in Jerusalem has been exposing the students to Israel in an academic sense, but I think also in what I might call a more experimental education, getting them out into the field and meeting with different people and having different experiences around the country. I heard this year that Jeremy Lee, who is sort of responsible now for Israel studies, sent students out to different, in particular, ones used to be called development towns, but towns that are on the periphery. Mm-hmm. And I think for many students, this was an incredible opportunity to meet with people who typically they don't encounter. And I think that gave them a broad opportunity. So I think that's part of it. Those students who avail themselves of different synagogue experiences and prayer experiences, I think for many of them that's been dramatic. And I have a sense that some of our students have been very ignited by particular teachers. Of course, all of them are very good, but it may well be that there's a particular student that they've got connected to as a mentor and so on. I would also say that one of the things that the college has been good at is looking after students, taking care of them. Back in the 70s, you know, many of these students have never come to Israel before, and many of them hadn't even traveled overseas before. So the idea of having a support system, which I remember Dr. Ezra Spicehandler, who was the head of the program, he demanded, I mean, I think that's the right word, that there would be a psychiatrist available on call for our students. That has, of course, changed because the college has been very good about having somebody who looks after student life. I mean, I could mention the name of Rose Guinnessar and Nancy Levy. These people have done, I think, a good job of trying to be there and being supportive.
The College Commons podcast belongs to HUC Connect, the online platform for continuing education from the Hebrew Union College. HUC Connect includes webinars, syllabi for community learning, and masterclasses for HUC alumni, with interviews, expert panels, and classroom materials on topics ranging from the arts to civil society, Israel, and much more. Check us out at huc.edu/HUC Connect. Now, back to our interview.
I want to reel the conversation back to the Hebrew language. You are, of course, correct that part of the college's purpose in requiring the year in Israel is linguistic. That is, we want to ensure that our American Reform rabbis have a grounding in Hebrew. Even in the story of Israel, and certainly in the story of diaspora, Hebrew language has always been present, but it has not followed a direct or linear evolution in the role that it plays in Judaism. So I want to ask you, David, as a person who has been building that bridge from our own Jewish identity to our own Jewish language of Hebrew and the Israeli experience, what does it mean for a civilization to be in a position where it has to uncover its own language, for it to have to learn the idiom of its own identity?
I think the challenge in English-speaking countries is that there is a tradition of monolithic sort of approach towards language, which is, well, the most of the world speaks English. There's less of a need for us to speak another language. And after all, we're integrating in the communities in which we live. So, of course, that's our primary language. That's in itself a challenge. Of course, the second challenge is the question of speaking languages. You need to be immersed in it. So for our students, when they come to Israel, you could argue they're immersed in it in the classroom, and to a degree they are engaged with it outside the classroom, although sometimes in a limited way. The problem is when they get back to America, where is the environment in which they can speak this language and use the language? Now, obviously, in the world of their studies, the written word and the reading of classic texts is there. Yiddish, for example, was able to sustain itself without a state framework. Mm-hmm. But of course, that's a whole different story. There's been an enormous amount of effort to try and broaden Hebrew speaking in the diaspora. There have been places where it's successful, and you and I know this about South America. So I think in a way, the challenge here is too many, in my opinion, see Hebrew only in the context of prayer. So, you know, I don't want to be pessimistic about this, but in some ways, I have to say I'm disappointed. Not about the college and not the college's investment in Hebrew, but actually what I think at the end of the day are circumstances which make it very difficult for us to be successful with the Hebrew language in diaspora context, especially diaspora context, which English speaking.
In that tranche of documents that you shared with me about the year in Israel from HUC's American Jewish Archives, I was struck by another theme that had to do with the nature of Jewish organizational cooperation. The program required a lot of shared effort across Israeli and American or international institutions. Mm-hmm. To give our listeners a taste of what this undertaking required, can you name a few of those players, be they funders or partners or what have you, and consider what this kind of collaborative spirit teaches us today?
It's very clear that the Central Conference of American Rabbis was very supportive of President Glick's program to mandate the year in Israel. So I think in that sense, terrific work within the Reform movement and its professional body. But one of the things that's really evident here is that for the program to succeed, there was an attempt to link up with all sorts of Jewish international organizations. The Jewish Agency is one example where funding was made available to help our students get stipends and to support the program itself. Then, of course, there was the World Zionist Organization that was part of this, I think, as well. We also have the American Friends of the Hebrew University and the Hebrew University itself. I mean, Avraham Harman, who was then president of the Hebrew University and had been a diplomat in the United States of America, was very, very sympathetic and did much to try and make this program happen. And I think one would have to add that, by the way, the Israeli government. I mean, it's fairly clear that the government was supportive and sympathetic. You know, the fact that Golda Meir attended during the course of the first year and received a honorary degree from the camp. I mean, there really was a lot of cooperation. I think part of that, of course, is also Glick's status. But I think, as you say, it was a sense of cooperation. And everybody seemed to have an interest. I think that's important to say. I think the Israeli government had an interest, the World Zionist Order, the Jewish Agency, of course, deepening relationships with the diaspora. And by the way, I would say here also, I think when Glick reached out to get funders, he also reached out to people who were funders of the United Jewish Appeal in America, saying, these rabbis that we're going to send to Israel are going to do our common work. And the common work was being ambassadors for Israel. So I think you're absolutely right that there was a commitment here, both from the Reform movement's shift in its attitude towards Israel, but also Israeli government's growing awareness of the importance of the potential to get support from diaspora Jewry, bearing in mind something that I think is in the article, but there is amongst certain Jews on the left a criticism that is emerging of Israel, what was the new left, I suppose, in the American context, which expands, of course, in due course. And there was a sense that, well, if we've got Reform rabbis coming to Israel and they're exposed to all these Israeli figures, which they were during the course of the year, then it would help Israel in terms of its PR campaign. So I think that's all common shared interest there.
I would like to conclude our conversation with a check-in, both for this moment in the spring of 2026, but also for posterity and future listeners. As we record this conversation, the United States and Israel remain at war with Iran, and Israel is at war with Hezbollah while also negotiating a very tenuous or downright dubious truce with the state of Lebanon. How are people on the HUC Jerusalem campus faring? And what are you seeing around you in Jerusalem in general?
Well, the first thing I should say is that although I have had some contact with the students, particularly at the beginning and the early months of the program, I'm not really in touch with them today, and I don't know the exact sort of situation. I think there are some students who've left Israel already, but there remains a core group who've been very committed, I think, to remaining here during this experience. This is a very difficult time. It's a difficult time because we've sort of been in a war for the last, almost 3 years now, Before then, we had what was called the Mapach HaMishpatit, the legal attempt to make judicial changes and undermine the judiciary in Israel. And I would say this compound of all of these different developments have led some of us, and I think here I'm speaking particularly for those who we might call more on the political, I mean, the word center-left is always a tricky term here in Israel, but that's, I suppose, who we are. I think there's a good degree of depression that's really hit us. And I have a feeling, again, I can't really speak for the college in Jerusalem, really, but I have a feeling that quite a few of us are really in a quite a difficult place, feeling that ideas and values that we've held very dear to us are being threatened and challenged. And given that we're not far away from an election, there are, of course, those who are optimistic amongst us that there'll be a change, but I don't think that's guaranteed. And who knows, you know, with the war, where there'll be an attempt to delay the elections. There have been all sorts of incidents in the country that suggest there are problems here. Our democracy is at the moment looking a bit shaky. And there are incidents on the streets that are very worrying. I mean, I could give you examples. One that's particularly close is that we have an educator who has had connections with us at HUC in Jerusalem, who has a kippah. And he's worn this kippah for 20 years. And on it, there is an Israeli flag and a Palestinian flag. And he was sitting in a coffee shop in Modi'in, and a man came up to him and told him that it was illegal to have a Palestinian flag, which, of course, he said is not true. But then the police came along and took him to the police station in Modi'in, where they put him in a cell for 20 minutes, took away his cell phone, and he couldn't make contact with anybody. And then when they released him, he said, "I would like my kippah back." And initially, I think they said no, but then they gave him the kippah, but they cut out the Palestinian flag. And this had a tremendous ripple effect. It got a lot of traction in the Israeli news on television, but also I think CNN covered it. And there was a demonstration outside the police station. I mean, this is just one of so many examples one could give where you feel as though there is, you know, real concern here. And I think, by the way, for our students, that's obviously something that on one level is fascinating because it shows you, you know, how engaged everybody is here. But the problem with the engagement is that we're having too many cases where it's becoming problematic. And our police force is led by a minister who I think has tried to turn the police into some type of arm of his political positions. One of my mentors, a man by the name of Muki Tzur, he's not just the historian of the kibbutz movement, but really the historian, I would say, of much of the labor movement. And he says, to be an educator, you must be an optimist. And if you're not an optimist, then you betray your profession. And I have to be honest with you that I sometimes feel I'm betraying my profession, according to Muki Tzur. But hopefully there will be some type of change, both on the front, which is the security military front and so on, and obviously on the internal issues as well.
Well, if we all pass through our moments of pessimism, I think we're allowed that. And I, for one, am grateful to have you, David Mendelson, as my colleague and educator at the Hebrew Union College. My very warmest to you and to all our colleagues and students and to Israel. And until our next conversation, many thanks.
Many thanks to you, Josh.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the College Commons Podcast, available wherever you listen to your podcasts. And check out HUC Connect, compelling conversations at the forefront of Jewish learning. For more information about all that HUC Connect has to offer, visit huc.edu/HUC Connect.